Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoors, the official podcast of Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. We live by the motto, it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. And we live the outdoor lifestyle every day. Whether you're a landowner or dreaming of joining the ranks of those closest to the earth, we're your brothers and sisters of the outdoors. We hunt, we fish, we're stewards of the land. And our Living the Dream team will show you the way to enjoying the land and all the outdoor pursuits it has to offer. Here's your host, Bill Cooper.
Welcome to the Living the Dream Outdoors podcast. This is Justin Brill. I'm here with Bill Cooper and Chase Seals. And Chase is a forester with the National Wild Turkey Federation working out of Southern Illinois. Welcome to the podcast, Chase.
Appreciate it, guys. Glad to be here.
Hey, glad to have you here. Always like to talk turkey.
Yes, sir.
So, Chase, you're a forester in Southern Illinois. Or what counties do you all work in, or what part of Illinois?
Yeah, so my job's kind of unique. The previous guy was on here, him and I are very similar. So we both work with the local NRCS offices. So through that side of my job, I cover the bottom 17 counties in Illinois. So if you go from west side, Mississippi River, over to the east side, I go Monroe, Randolph, Perry, Franklin, Saline, Williamson, White County and Hamilton County, and then everything south, all the way from river to river.
So about the southern quarter of the state.
Yeah, almost everything under I-64.
Yeah, pretty well.
So to do that for NRCS, and then the other side of my job is I work with the Shawnee National Forest doing stewardship work, helping manage the largest public body of land in the state.
And that's so awesome. Shawnee National Forest is about 284,000
acres.
284,000 wow. acres. All right. Yeah, you got it. I use that as a sales pitch whenever I'm promoting properties in Southern Illinois. Yeah. I said you buy this ground, but you also have access to about 250,000 acres.
Yeah.
Yep. And it's a big area, and there's some good quality deer hunting. Turkey hunting down through that area.
Several buddies of mine make trips every year to come up here and hunt on the Shawnee.
Yep. So. And then you say your buddies come up. So originally
I'm from Alabama, born and raised.
Alabama.
Spent 27 years down there. And before anybody starts asking questions, I am a war eagle through and through. Don't say those three-letter words. I don't like it.
Yeah.
The crimson and white can stay away. Orange and blue all day, baby.
Well, I'm from Mississippi County, Missouri, which is right across the river. Yeah, I grew up on a cotton farm down there.
All righty.
You betcha. And the only reason I ever went to Illinois, I used to go to some lake over there, Horseshoe Lake, I think.
Yeah.
Just to see the Canada geese. I think they've all disappeared now.
Yeah, there's not many down there anymore, unfortunately.
No.
Times have changed.
Yeah, it's but definitely times have changed. My dad talked about that. They'd go down to in Ware, Illinois.
Yep.
And they'd go, they had the firing line.
Yeah.
And it was basically a tree line that, in between two fields.
Yep.
And they'd go out there and they were in their younger days and they'd do some partying and maybe close the bar down and then hop in the old car and drive down there. And they'd throw out, at that point in time, there wasn't all the fancy camo and decoys.
No.
And it was silhouettes that they hand painted and Carhartt Browns. And they just put them out. They'd put those decoys out. They'd stand in the tree line and it was a fire in the line because it was like the old Civil War. People just lined up and geese came in and just they'd wear them out. And he talked about, man, their guys would be fighting and, who shot what goose and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But he said there were so many geese down there by Thanksgiving. I mean, it was nothing to go down there and kill your limit.
I've heard some locals there. I live in Marion, Illinois, which is kind of the central part of Southern Illinois. And I've heard some locals down there talk about it. And they said back in the day when in the heyday of geese, they said the heck would use decoys. They'd go get old tires and cut them in half.
Yeah.
They just see that black silhouette sitting on the ground and the geese would flock in.
Yeah, it was.
It's crazy.
And what amazes me is, I still duck and goose hunt a little bit, not near as much as I used to. I know you're still a duck hunter.
Yeah.
And Dad talks about, like I said, it would be Thanksgiving. Now, does duck season barely even open by Thanksgiving, let alone geese?
Yeah, it opens a Saturday after.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a late season.
That's your regular season duck and goose opener in Southern Illinois now.
But you guys are talking about the old days. Now, I can identify. I raised over in a boot hill, and we had ducks and geese all over our farm. We never hunted them. I never duck hunted until I was in college.
Right.
And I got out on my own and everything. I decided I was going to start duck hunting. And, just out of college, you ain't got a lot of change in your pocket.
I understand that.
I got some old white bleach bottom painted black wings on them. threw them out and killed ducks like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, man, if that worked on ducks, it ought to work on turkeys. They didn't like it.
They analyzed that decoy a little bit more.
Yeah, turkeys are a little more finicky.
Yeah, they really are. I learned that lesson pretty quick.
They like to sit there and go, is that actually moving? Does
yeah.
that look well, right?
In fact, that's been almost 50 years ago. I've been thinking about going back to that spot and see if that bleach bottle decoy is still staked in the ground.
I bet it's gone.
I tell you what, though, after walking around here, you know, and seeing the decoys, and they're so lifelike and stuff. Now, I couldn't hunt over one of them Jake decoys. I like to take that midday nap, and I wake up and see that there. I'd have one less decoy.
Yeah. You'd have peppered it with some TSS.
Yeah.
They're incredible. I actually ride for GSM Outdoors. They're a couple of halls away here. But they got the Avon X decoys anymore.
Yeah.
The detail on those things are just
It's funny you
phenomenal.
Say that. So I'll give you a quick turkey story real quick.
We love turkey stories.
This past season, I was took my buddy and his son out. His son just turned 10, or 9 or 10, I can't remember now. Just turned it. And the year before, I took him out and got him his first turkey ever.
Awesome.
And I spoiled him. I got him a big gobbler, had 12-inch beard, 1.5-inch spurs.
First birdie ever shot.
So fast forward to this past season, we go out there, and I think, I can't remember if it's first or second season in Illinois South Zone. But anyhow, we go out, we're hunting, last day of his tag, finally get on a bird, get it to do right. Bird comes in, I got a brand spanking new Avian X hen decoy sitting there. Bird walks up behind it in full strut. The hen finally sees something and she doesn't like it, starts to putt. Luckily, the gobbler wasn't paying any attention to her. He was locked in just strutting for the decoy. My buddy's son, he shoots that 20-gauge with old Winchester lead shot, knocks my decoy over, turkey hits the ground flopping, and I didn't think nothing about it. I kind of thought maybe it was just the percussion around that shot going through. Pick my decoy up, and he accidentally shake it, and I hear pellets just rattling in the head. I got to look, and he put about 5 or 6 pellets in the brand-new decoy right in the head.
Yeah.
Well, I got lots of duck decoys like that, you know. Love taking youth a teal hunting, because teal decoy so easily. I usually let them sit down and flush them so they got a straightaway shot.
Yeah.
Well, some of them 12, 13, 14-year-old boys really get excited, you know. I don't let them shoot them on the water, but they can see daylight between your feet in the water, they start shooting.
Hey, I might be 33 now, but I still do that.
I was going to say, it's not just 12, 13-year-old boys. Some of us that are still in our 30s and 40s get that way, too.
As long as the decoy looks safe, I'm slinging.
That's right. Yeah. No dog, we're good.
Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
Oh, that's good stuff.
Oh, love it.
So you said half of what you do is working with private landowners, and then the other half is the public section.
Yeah, it's pretty much split 50-50 for me. So we'll start with the private side, and then we'll finish off with the public side of things. So, you know, with the private side of the job, I'm based out of the NRCS offices. Technically, I'm based out of the Marion Field office there. But again, I cover the bottom 17 counties. So your NRCS offices in like Pinckneyville, Sparta, over in Murfreesboro, down in Tams, Anna, over in Harrisburg.
One in every county, right?
No, when you get south down there, like Harrisburg covers Saline County and
Hardin
County and
Gallatin.
I think it might – no, Gallatin's north. It's Rhonda Cox's ranges. Anyhow, so you get down in that southern kind of really rural area down there in southeast southern Illinois, and the counties cover a few more. Vianna's the other one I forgot, Illinois.
Yep.
So that office, it covers Johnson County, Pope County, and Massac County.
Okay. But you work out of all – I mean, you're primarily located –
I'm based out of the Marion Field office,
right.
But I cover all those offices, which covers those bottom 17 counties. But, yeah, so like I said, I work for those offices. So, basically, what I do is I provide forestry and wildlife technical assistance for private landowners through the NRCS offices. So, if you've got questions about wildlife habitat, forest management, so forth, and you go to your local office, they're going to contact me or a local DNR forester, one of the two of us, are going to be their kind of go-tos. If you're looking from a timber side, timber or wildlife base. If you're looking really grass side on your questions, they're probably going to lean you more towards your quail and pheasants forever, farm bill biologist versus me. you know, I know a lot of stuff, but I don't claim to be a grass expert. So,
yeah. Well, and a lot of the properties that we have in southern Illinois, especially that part, I mean, when you start getting towards that Shawnee area, they're primarily forested, but a lot of our stuff is a mix where there's open ground, there's timber. So, and I know you have a good relationship with the guys from Quail Forever, like Preston.
Yeah.
And, you know, you guys work together and come up with a plan together as far as what to do on the timber, what to do on the grass.
Yeah, I mean, like you bring that up. So a prime example of how we kind of work together to help landowners and help them get into contracts. You mentioned Preston Chapman is a great farm bill biologist that works for PF there. He's based out of the Pinckneyville office. Him, Preston and I are great buddies, and we just worked together on a property there outside Chester, big landowner. I wrote a forest management plan for it, and Preston handled all the open ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's taking a property that he's kind of managed on his own based off the stuff that's generally out there on the web. And he's done some good stuff, and he's done some stuff that was wrong, and he realizes it. And he's using us to correct moving forward so that he can improve his forest from the standpoint of making it better deer and turkey habitat, but also making it a healthier forest so it's going to be there long term. And then on the other side of it, he kind of went down the road of planting a monoculture of switchgrass.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of guys promote it. A lot of guys like switchgrass, but when you do a monoculture of it, it's bad for wildlife. There's no food value to it. You might get a little bit of bedding in it per se, but in this guy's case, it got so thick that his deer wasn't even using it.
And that's the thing. The guys will devote whole big sections to that, and it gets so thick and woolly, they'll bed on the edge. But they can't get to the middle of it.
Correct.
And even other critters, turkeys, quail, everything, it gets so thick.
Yep.
It's like trying to walk through a wall.
Yeah, it's not fun.
No.
I had to walk through some of it.
No.
But anyhow, so Preston and I got together and basically kind of, you know, bumped our heads together and because Preston's also forestry training as well. So him and I were, you know, close at hand and got everything dialed up for the guy. And then we've got him applications in right now for CSP.
Right.
He's going to try to get a CSP timber contract and a CSP grass contract.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a prime example of how me and another biologist can work together to do a full property. That's the word I'm looking for.
Plan.
Yeah, full property plan, you know.
Right.
Yeah, but, you know, and there's a lot of different programs within NRCS and you know, from a forestry standpoint, your main programs right now that are available to landowners is going to be EQIP, which is an Environmental Quality Incentive Program, and then CSP, which is your Conservation Stewardship Program. So those are your two main programs for folks looking to do forest management through an NRCS cost share program. They're great programs. You know, your CSP contract is really geared to somebody that's adamant about management. That they're really looking to do some of it themselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great program. It pays out pretty well. CSP has an annual currently. And again, this is all subject to change. We're talking about federal programs and federal budgets, and we all know what's going on right now with stuff. So stuff will change eventually. But currently, CSP program, you sign up for it, you get a $4,000 annual payment for being in the program. Then you get cost share rates on top of that. Some of those cost share rates are not going to be as high as, say, being an EQIP.
Right.
For instance, invasive species, it does not pay as high on that.
But you're getting the $4,000 up front.
You've got that $4,000 right there. You know, your CSP contracts, they pay out one time a year. So you also have to be somebody that can think about and budget to be effective with it. Whereas your EQIP contracts, they pay out as you complete the practice.
Right.
So if you're worried about trying to budget things out, so forth, so on, you know, if you're a small landowner that doesn't have a lot of, you know, fluid funds to play with to manage your property and you're really just kind of going paycheck to paycheck type deal and you want to do something, EQIP's probably your better bet because as soon as that's done and you tell the office that contract item is done, they're going to call me or DNR Forester and say, hey, go look at it. As soon as we come out and look at it and sign the paperwork and everything's good, they're going to cut a check, and you'll have a check in a couple weeks.
Yeah, and it's from – and I've been in – currently I'm in EQIP. We're applying for – what was the other one?
CSP.
CSP. So it seemed like EQIP kind of really good for when you're first starting out. You're doing your bigger projects, and it seemed like CSP is more so when you're getting into the maintenance mode. Like you've done a lot of the stuff, and it's more so you're going to keep doing different things, but your giant big projects are really done.
Yeah. Yeah, and EQIP – tends to work out better when you're dealing with a heavy invasive load.
Right.
If you're treating a lot of invasive species, you know, if you're not familiar with what I'm saying, invasive species, particularly in southern Illinois and most of southern Missouri too, we're talking autumnolive, multiflora rose, bush honeysuckle, on the what we call herbaceous side of it. We're talking Japanese stiltgrass, Japanese chaff flower for the most part. Mm-hmm. There's some others that pop up here and there. Garlic mustard's another one that a lot of you may have heard about.
Lespedezas.
Yep, Lespedeza. Luckily for me, that tends to stay in the fields and not get in the timber
right,
as much.
That's
so
true.
But I have seen it in some openings before, so it does get around. That kind of, your equip contracts tend to play better, pay out better for those invasive invasive practices.
Cool.
Well, I hate to interrupt a good conversation here, but we need to take just a short break, and folks, don't go away because we're going to be right back, and we're going to talk some more turkey management.
Our forefathers gave us a Bill of Rights. One of those is the right to step in the front door of Pond Center, where the faint sound of eagles screeching from on high a bounding purple mountain's majesty browls the walls full of glorious firearms. It's hard not to shed a patriotic tear as your red, white, and blue blood becomes fortified by the sight of true freedom. Pond Center, located at 408 Highway 72 East in Rolla, Missouri. Or give us a call at 573-426-GUNS.
Hey, this is John from CoAngler.com. Did you know that CoAngler.com is the newest online platform to connect anglers for fishing trips? You can create your free account, offer and request fishing trips, connect with anglers in your area, share some costs, share some knowledge, and share a great time in the outdoors. Whether you're fishing from a boat and you got an extra seat and want somebody to come with you, or you need some help shuttling those kayaks for your next float trip, CoAngler is a great way to connect with like-minded anglers in your area for a great time out on the water. So get on CoAngler.com and let's go fishing.
Hey there, listeners. At Conservation Federation of Missouri, we're more than just advocates for our environment. We're active in making a difference through hands-on programs that protect and preserve Missouri's natural resources. By becoming a member, you're supporting impactful initiatives like Share the Harvest, which provides venison to families in need, and Operation Game Thief, which helps combat poaching and protects our wildlife. You're also contributing to the RISPR grants, which fund local conservation projects across the state. Your membership makes these vital programs possible, ensuring that we continue to serve both our communities and our environment. Plus, as a member, you'll receive updates on these programs, invitations to exclusive events, and the opportunity to get involved in the work you care about most. Visit confedmo.org/join to learn more and to join us today. Together, we can support programs that protect Missouri's wildlife, waters, and way of life. Be a part of the Conservation Federation of Missouri, where action leads to conservation.
Hey everyone, this is Michael Collins with Misty Mountains Guiding Service. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what we offer. Misty Mountains is a smallmouth and trout-specific guiding service that caters to the northern Ozarks region. My areas include the Upper Merrimack River, the Gasconade, and a few smaller creeks in the Mid-Missouri area. Whether you enjoy casting streamers to bass, drifting a dry fly, or ripping lips with spinning gear, I've got you covered. Fishing is made easy in my state-of-the-art drift boat raft. I control the boat with ease while you or yourself and a buddy do all the work at catching fish. Besides a great day on the water, I provide all needed gear, a delicious shore lunch, and as much fishing knowledge as you can carry with you on the way home. Spots for the 2024 season are going fast. Give me a call or text today to get your trip booked. My number is 573-823-9057. Find me on Facebook and Instagram at Misty Mountains Guiding Service. It's always an adventure with Misty Mountains.
This is Dan from the White Buffalo Fly Shop, your gateway to Missouri's blue ribbon trout streams and world-class smallmouth water. Whether you're headed to Mill Creek, the Kern, or the Gasconade, we've got the flies, the gear, and the local know-how to help you fish with confidence. If you're looking to sharpen your casting skills, join one of our hands-on clinics. Or if you'd like to craft your own fly rod, build it with us in one of our rod building courses. You're always welcome in our fly tying nights to swap stories, share patterns, and get the latest hatch reports. White Buffalo Fly Shop is more than just a place to gear up. It's a hub for our local community. You'll find us at 605 North Pine Street in Rolla or online at whitebuffaloflyshop.com.
Hey, everybody. This is Alex Rutledge with American Roots Outdoors. Check out my buddy's podcast show, Living the Dream Outdoors with Bill Cooper and Hunter Hindman. You're really going to enjoy this week's show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Living Dream Outdoors podcast. We're here with Bill Cooper and Chase Seals from Forrester for the NWTF, and we're talking about habitat and projects going on in southern Illinois.
Alrighty. So, yeah, so like I said, the first section there, we talked about private land stuff, but now we're going to get into the public side of it. So the other side of my job is I work for the Shawnee, or work with the Shawnee National Forest. I'm a partner with the National Forest down here, and I try to help them manage the public property to improve the overall habitat, whether it's from game or non-game species, as well as improve the overall forest health on the Shawnee. Just a quick biology lesson for folks, or ecology lesson, I should say. The Shawnee National Forest and most of the state of Illinois is natively a oak hickory ecosystem. So oak and hickory is the dominant trees in our timber, in our forest stands. Without management, we're going through a term that we call mesification, which is a transition into a climax forest or final stage forest, which is going to be maple, beech, elm for the most part throughout the state. And when you hit that stage, you're losing all your oak, you're losing all your hickories, you're losing all that mass production. We're decreasing the amount of wildlife we can hold within our timber stands. And so, you know, dive in into a little bit deeper, you're going to lose your invertebrates, you know, other associated wildlife, per se, insects. You're going to have a drastic drop of everything across the board as that happens.
So how does that happen to where it switches from your oak hickory dominated forest to why are the maples and these other trees taking over?
So your oak hickory forest, it's a forest that thrives off disturbance, thrives off management. Now, prior to humans becoming the main thing on the landscape and influencing everything, Mother Nature did it. You know, there'd be natural disasters come through, a tornado come through, heavy wind event, something like that, that would break the canopy up. Plus, a lot of people don't realize that all your ecosystems, even your western ecosystems, they have a fire interval. Fire is on the landscape at some time period for anywhere. Doesn't matter. Like, the only thing that's not going to burn for the most part is your swamps down in Louisiana and Florida. Right. And even then, at times, that grass on top will burn over the water. So there is a fire interval. Yeah, there is a fire interval for every ecosystem on the land. So for our Southern Illinois oak hickory ecosystem, it's generally a 3 to 5 year return interval. So every 3 to 5 years, you would see fire on the landscape. And so prior to human settlement and involvement, that fire would basically run river to river, or, you know, a river to a canyon it couldn't cross, or something, some natural break that would stop it. Now we're here, we've got roads everywhere and so forth, so on. So it's kind of made it impossible for nature to manage as she used to.
Right.
So at this point, it's on us to manage that property, to mimic nature as close as we can to maintain what should be here.
Right.
So if we don't do that, those soft hardwood species move in because they thrive in shade. And then as some sort of disturbance occurs, now they pop up because they grow faster than your native oak hickory. They take over that canopy gap. Then they start putting out shade, and they put out a lot more shade than your native species do. And that chokes out our native species. They can't get reestablished underneath it.
And so, I'm sorry to interrupt.
But I was going to say, without management, then therefore it eventually transitions over to that, and now we've lost it.
Right. And then when those different species, when those come in, theirs are not as much fire tolerant species.
Correct.
The leaves and the debris and stuff that they leave themselves, like oak leaves, they lay on the ground, they curl up, they dry, they get real crunchy, and it's good for air loft through there. And then so when you burn that, the fire filters through there.
Runs really well. Soft hardwood species, they tend to lay really flat. They hold a lot of moisture. They don't get a lot of air movement in them. So therefore, fire doesn't want to carry through their leaf litter as well. And also, your soft hardwood species are thinner barked compared to your oak and your hickory. Your oak and hickory are thick bark species. They're designed or developed to be adapted to fire. They expect to have fire come through at some point. So their bark's thicker, so they protect their cambium layer. So a fire can come through, long as it's not a raging fire, and it doesn't kill them. It doesn't really impact them at all, actually. It actually helps them. It typically prepares a seed bed. If there's already acorns or other mass on the ground, it helps to stratify it and hopefully get those established, so forth, so on. Whereas your soft hardwoods are thin bark, so as soon as that fire comes through, it automatically gets to the cambium layer and therefore impacts those trees. Depending on the diameter of those trees, it may take several fires for it to kill it, but eventually fire will kill a soft hardwood species out.
Right, mm-hmm. And it basically it boils that layer.
Yeah.
And that's what kills
so,
it off.
So folks that don't know a lot about tree physiology, your cambium layer is your living tissue. It's where all of your nutrient flow, water uptake, all that's occurring within that tree because it is a living organism. So as that fire comes through, because all your fluids are in that tissue, it boils that tissue and cooks it, and that's what kills them.
Yeah, and the oak hickory forest actually evolved in the face of fire. Is that true?
Correct. Yeah, your oak hickory, they love fire. Again, you want it on a certain interval.
Right.
And, you know, there's places that I've seen, you know, for instance, Crab Orchard Refuge, their head fire guy, David Jones, great guy, very knowledgeable, does a lot of great management on the refuge, trying to reclaim that place that's gotten out of hand, honestly, in a lot of places.
Yeah.
But because of the oak litter being so adaptive to fire and great for fire, he's got places where he's able to burn sometimes twice a year because
really?
He gets enough leaf drop.
Wow.
Yeah. So when certain situations, you can actually get multiple fires in a year in the native oak hickory, but you got to be careful.
Right.
Because if you burn on the wrong conditions, so forth, so on,
you can damage.
You can
those
still
trees.
Impact what right. you want to preserve. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's funny. We had Will on the last podcast.
Yeah.
We were talking about, you know, different things in the woodlands and stuff like that. And that's so much of our, you know, people. You look at it, and I think it's one of them things. It's like your kid. You know,
yeah.
if you see your kid every day, you don't realize how much he's grown or she's grown.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
but you know, someone hasn't seen him in 6 months. They're like, oh my God, look how much he's changed. And I think it's the same way with our landscape.
Yeah.
Because people say, oh, no, this is the exact same way it was 30, 40 years ago. And no, it wasn't. Because first of all, in our area, like you talked about the invasives, there wasn't bush honeysuckle. There wasn't, it has changed. But since you see it every day or every year, you don't really realize it.
Yep. So that's awesome, man. So, yeah, let's get back since I went down the rabbit hole of kind of tree physiology and biology of the ecosystem that we love down here and everything. So, like I said, we started this off. I was going to talk about the public property that I help manage. So, to kind of explain things a little bit to everybody. So, me as a partner forester, I work with the Shawnee National Forest. And basically what we do is a lot of what we call stewardship contracts. And essentially the Forest Service gets a pot of money. And they say, hey, we've got some money, we want to do some work. And it's a lot easier for them to contract it out with me and let me contract to a subcontractor to physically do the work, you know, and let me just oversee everything. Because on the federal side, they got to go through so many hoops and this and that kind of stuff to get things contracted out. And then there's all these stipulations, you know, if something's going wrong, like they got to check all these boxes before they can do anything, if a contractor's doing wrong, so forth. Whereas they dump it on me, I'm a private private entity outside of the federal system,
right.
I still have to abide by their contract and what needs to get done and stuff. Mm-hmm. But let's say my contractor messes up. I can go out there and say, hey, dude, you screwed up. Let's get it fixed. If he doesn't, I can tell him to take a hike,
right.
pack your stuff up and get on. Whereas the federal government can't do that quickly.
Right.
So, like I said, work through stewardship contracts. A lot of folks I hear kind of question, the money that's raised at banquets and how that gets put back in the landscape and that kind of stuff. So we take revenue from banquets. Every state chapter gets a pot of money from the banquets that they're raising their state, and they get that money back. And then since the state of Illinois, the state chapter puts away X amount of funds, and they say, hey, that's your pot, basically. And so I use that to leverage as match on agreements.
Right.
So a Forest Service may come to me and say, hey, I've got $200,000 that I want to put in an agreement. And then I'll figure out what the match percentage I need is. And I'll say, okay, I'll pull it, work with my district biologist, John Burke, and I'll pull that funds out, put it in as match so we hit the match requirement we need for a federal agreement. And then we'll put all this stuff down and get a contract ink. And now it's on me to implement it. You know, so I've got, currently I've got three active agreements. I've got the Buttermilk Hill Wildlife Project, and it's predominantly been on the western side of the forest, but we've done a little bit on the eastern side. I've done a lot of work with that one around actual Buttermilk Hill Trail. Folks are familiar with that in Jackson County. It's just off the Union Line in Jackson. Oakwood Bottoms, done a lot of work down in Oakwood Bottoms, speaking of projects related or news stories related to a project, per se. Folks that are familiar with Southern Illinois and those that may get the Turkey Call magazine, probably seen the article that was in there last year about mm-hmm. this getting March of last year, basically,
yep.
or April. So I had a project there, and we ended up planting almost 54,000 seedlings in oak wood bottoms to basically understock an oak stand down there that's got a lot of pin oak in it, and that pin oak's having a lot of issues with gall infestation. So eventually those pin oaks are going to die off. So we came in and underplanted this stand and planted a whole bunch of bur oak, pecan, cypress, swamp chestnut oak, swamp white oak. I'm blanking. There's a couple other species.
But native species.
Yeah, all native species that and species that are developed to have in wet feet.
Yeah.
To some degree. So we've underplanted that stand so that down the road, we're going to have good regeneration underneath that. So as those pin oaks start to die off because of gall infestation, we've got stuff to replace it and right. keep it in the native oak hickory type ecosystem. So that was that project. And I got that, those seedlings, I actually paid for that through a grant that I got from Arbor Day.
Okay.
Yep. So I used a grant to cover the seedling cost, and then Forest Service pitched in to cover the planting cost on that. So another agreement I've got going is the Logmark Pine Stewardship Agreement. So on this agreement, I've done a lot of work in Pope County
okay.
and Johnson County.
Yep.
Those have been my primary counties there. So if you guys are familiar with Pope and Johnson County, so in Johnson County, right there in Vienna, mm-hmm. if you go to Vienna and you go north into what they call Bowman's Bottom, if you go on the east side of I-24, I have treated probably 75 to 85% of that Forest Service block.
Really?
Right there. Yeah.
We it's have a big
treated,
area.
Yeah, we treated a lot of it.
How many, if you had to guess, like how many acres, public land acres, have you influenced in your time there?
So I've been working for NWTF in Illinois for 5 years now.
Okay.
I actually had to do this for a report recently. I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head. But contract-wise, I've got, I think it's between 4 and 5,000 acres wrapped up in contracts.
Okay.
And to date, I think we're at about 3,100 to 3,200 acres actually completed, work's done, to what we call conserved acres.
Right.
So
that's, you know, in like we just had our local banquet
yeah.
Last week, and you do hear people talk about, like, where's the, you know, you got your $35 membership, you're paying for the banquet,
yeah.
we're raising money for all this stuff. Well, where does that go? And that's where it goes.
Yeah,
it goes to the public land, and it's to improve all types of, not just turkeys. It affects everything in
yeah,
a positive
so,
way.
You know, we are the Wild Turkey Federation, and yes, turkeys are centric for this organization, and all of us, for the most part, are hunters, and we all love to hunt turkeys, and we think about and dream about turkeys all the time.
Yes, sir.
But when it comes to management is not singular. You don't manage for a single species. Because when you do that, you end up messing up your habitat, and you're excluding other wildlife that are beneficial.
Right.
So, yes, turkeys are centric, and we are going to think, how is this going to impact turkeys? What's the best use of this to get the best bang for buck out of turkeys?
Right.
But I'm also looking at everything going, okay, we're going to impact all these songbirds. We're going to impact white-tailed deer. We're going to potentially impact quail. You know, there's a lot of folks that used to love to hunt quail in Southern Illinois, and quail are few and far between now. Luckily, there's still some native populations, but they're few and far between. So we're going to look at it and go, how can we impact the most wildlife, game and non-game, across the landscape with what we're doing, but still be beneficial for turkeys?
And realistically, it seems like a lot from, you know, the conversations we've been having with yourself and, you know, other foresters, and it's really setting it back to how it should be.
Yeah.
It's getting it back to its native state.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. That kind of, you know, some folks might hear a little bit of grumblings down in Southern Illinois. There's some environmental groups that aren't the biggest fan of active management on the Shawnee National Forest, and you know, and I'm not going to go into details on there because that's a long saga. But, you know, like you said, our management is mimicking natural management that Mother Nature would have done. So we're doing what she would have done, which is essentially what they're asking for is, hey, let Mother Nature do it.
Right.
The problem is you can't do that anymore because us humans as a species have divided the land up in a way that Mother Nature cannot effectively manage.
Right.
Therefore, we have to step in and try to mimic what she would have done in order to maintain the native ecosystems.
Right. And it's like anything else. It has to be managed, actively managed. It can't just, you can't just let it go. It's not, this isn't set it and forget it.
Right.
I mean, it may not be actively. It's not like you got to be out there every day doing something.
Correct.
But like you said, every 3 to 5 years, you got to run a fire through it.
Yeah.
You got to do it. It's really, yep. I mean.
You know, TSI works, usually a 10-year return interval.
Exactly.
You do it once, and it's usually good for about 10 years before you have to potentially do it again if it's done right. You know, stuff like that. And then, so then I said there was 3 agreements. And the last one is Kincaid Lake Shoreline Restoration. So those that are familiar with Jackson County and Kincaid Lake. So basically, we're doing a buffer strip along the lake, trying to improve the shoreline there, getting, again, mesification's happening big time there, that transition. So we're trying to get all the soft hardwoods out, invasive species where they're popping up. And there's also a native species that's kind of on the threatened, endangered. It's being monitored. It's native giant cane.
Mm-hmm.
You don't find a lot of it anymore. And so that's kind of one species eccentric of that agreement is we're trying to promote that when we find it. We find those patches, release it really good so it gets sunlight and keeps growing.
Right. Diversification. You're trying to get...
Again, diversification.
You got to have...
Is giant cane really beneficial for turkeys?
Yeah.
Not really.
Right.
But it's a native species. You know... Again, we're looking landscape here.
Right.
We're still, everything we're doing outside of that, great for turkeys.
Yeah.
But what we're doing is also going to help a native species that's few and far between now.
Right. And on your public land stuff, you're looking at it more so from a, and I'm looking at it like a public versus private. You know,
right.
if you come out and look at my 40 acres, we're talking kind of a micro.
Yeah.
Climate, you know, as far as what our management and what we're trying to do. When you're looking at big tracts of public ground, that's macro. To where you know, across the board, it may, you know, this area where you're having the cane or whatever, like you said, that's not perfect for turkeys, but that's what was there before. That's what's going to thrive. And then once you get it going and you maintain it, you don't have to really, then it is set it and forget it. You don't really have to do that much to it, except for maybe every once in a while, you know, spray out invasive species, you know,
river
cane. I can't imagine you burn that.
The cane?
Yeah.
No, it's actually fire adaptive.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, there you go. See, I'm learning something. It's, you know, like so every couple of years.
It's actually a disturbance dependent species.
Really?
Yeah. Lack of disturbance is why timber's kind of choking it out, essentially, overtopping it.
Makes sense.
So, yeah.
Good stuff. So, it's glad to see. I'm glad you came on, and I'm glad you explained where these dollars go to. Because, I mean, there is a lot of money that goes into this stuff. Is that, do you know, is that where the majority now of where NWTF funds are going is into the habitat, or?
It's going to be habitat and research.
That's
I mean, everything goes into the national pot, and then, you know, headquarters is going to take their sliver out of it, per se, and that's where all your research funds are going to come from.
Right.
They're going to use that divvy out to research. And then you've got stuff that gets kicked back to the states. And then, for instance, my state of Illinois, you know, they're gracious and they give me a pot of money that's pretty much earmarked. And it's like, hey, all right, when you get an agreement going, you know, grant, yeah, you know, for those in Illinois that are like, yeah, you're just talking about the southern part of the state. If I find an avenue and I can get up somewhere else and some public ground up north and do something, I gladly will.
Right.
But right now.
You're in the southern part of it, and that's what we're primarily focusing on right now, because that's what you know.
Yeah.
And, and that's where I do most of my work, too. So I do a lot of work through the Shawnee and southern. And it's, people don't realize that is that southern quarter of the state that you're talking about, that's almost more like Missouri Ozarks.
Oh, well, it is.
It's part of the Ozarks. People in Missouri don't like to admit it.
Yeah.
But
but that Jackson Union County and northern Alexander County area right there of southern Illinois is just an extension of the Ozarks.
Yeah.
It doesn't go as far over there as it is over here.
You call it what you will, Bill.
Okay.
It doesn't extend too far, but there's a little bit of the Ozark remnants right there.
Oh, for sure. And there's some really cool place, Garden of the Gods. And just some
beautiful.
Well, you talked about Kincaid Lake. That's everybody thinks in Illinois we got these muddy lakes, and you know, we don't, not Kincaid.
No, it's
that
clean.
Thing is gin clear.
There's muskies in there, right?
There are muskies in there. And
muskie and wall,
I know a little bit about Illinois.
I think state record crappie came out of there.
I saw that somebody caught a new state record.
Well, the old one from a couple years ago, that was caught out of there. And that was a funny thing. They caught it. They're like, oh, I don't want to say where I was at. And then he's like telling the story. He's like, yeah, when I hooked it, I thought I hooked a muskie. Well, there's only like three. There's only like three lakes in southern Illinois.
Cedar and
it's good stuff. But all right, well, I appreciate you coming on today.
I appreciate you guys having me.
Hey, man, I heard some new information, and you know, I do double duty with these podcasts. I turn a lot of them into newspaper articles as well.
Uh oh,
You just made it easy. Hey, folks, we are Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast. We appreciate you listening. And we all are enjoying our outdoor dreams. We encourage you to get outdoors and enjoy your dreams as well. I'm Bill Cooper.
People love a good mustache. People also love a good firearm. The fine people down at Pond Center like both. They have the largest selections of firearms in the area, and with a friendly, knowledgeable staff of hombres to help you pick the gun that's right for you. You could end up riding into the sunset with a gun you love. Find them at pc72guns.com, on shelf, in store, online, or give them a call at 573-426-GUNS. That's Pond Center. Guns welcome. Mustache appreciated.
Captain Brian Wilson runs one of the tightest bow fishing operations in the business. Stainwater Bow Fishing operates out of Jerome, Missouri, and the beautiful Missouri Ozarks. They cover most Ozark streams and lakes. You haven't lived until you've searched Ozark waters during the night with Stainwater Bow Fishing while looking for giant gar, carp, and buffalo. Captain Wilson also runs a second boat on Taneycomo Lake. Call today to book a trip with Stainwater Bow Fishing at 573-263-8016. Again, that's 573-263-8016. Be sure and shoot straight.
The Living the Dream Outdoors podcast is brought to you by Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, The Fly Rod Journals, SmokerBuilder.com, Cowtown USA, Westover Farms, Scenic Rivers Taxidermy, Stained Water Bow Fishing, Scenic Rivers Guide Service and Tours, Huzzah Valley Resort, Pico Lures, Devil's Backbone Outfitters, J&J Charters, Kaufman Cove, Alaska, Bean Creek Game Calls, Misty Mountain Guide Service, ASO Guides and Outfitters with Ryan Walker, Expedition Trailers, The Rambling Angler, and Rich's Famous Burgers.
Land ownership is the American dream. Land is the basis of all life. Our wise use of this most precious of resources ensures the survival and growth of free institutions and our American way of life. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we value the traditions and freedoms that land provides us. Every day we seek the solace of a mountain sunrise over traffic jams and smog, the calming silence of a bubbling stream over the sirens of the city, and the quiet of the countryside over the hustle and bustle of the world. We hunt, we fish, we farm. We live off the land. It's our mission to help our clients live out their dreams on the land as we do. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we believe that it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. Join us 5 days a week on Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast as the Living the Dream Outdoor Dream Team explores the most desired outdoor properties in the Midwest and whisks you away to incredible hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation opportunities. Host Bill Cooper, an inductee of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, will be joined by members of the Living the Dream Outdoors team each week as they tell tall tales, unveil tips and tactics, and rub elbows with some of the biggest names in the outdoor world. You'll also find the Living the Dream Outdoors podcast on your favorite social media platforms, including Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok.